All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 635 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 133. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be focusing a lot on some mechanisms. I just decided to kind of collate some kind of strange mechanisms that people do not pay attention to, but actually end up showing up a lot on the USMLE exams. They tend to be a little kind of basic sciencey, but again, very important. Although we'll also just discuss some classic vignettes as we go. So what if they give you a question about a 24-year-old female and they tell you that for the past 4 days, she has been having a lot of joint pain. And they tell you that on physical exam, she has this vesicular rash that's kind of diffuse. And that she also has tenderness like on her wrists and in her fingers and things like that. What should you be thinking about here? Well, I really hope you're saying that, oh, Divine, this person has gonococcal arthritis, right? This person has aseptic arthritis caused by Neisseria gonorrhea, right? So what is the classic presentation of that septic arthritis going to be? Well, it's going to be a person that is sexually active, right? A person that is sexually active. Although on the USMLE exams, they can also give it to a person that has a terminal complement protein defect, right? So remember, when people have a C5 or C6 or C7 or C8 or C9 defects, it does increase their risk of Neisseria infections, either Neisseria meningitis or Neisseria gonorrhea, right? So if a person has a terminal complement protein defect, a C5 to C9 defect, it's going to increase their risk of Neisseria infections, both gonococcus or meningococcal. Okay, so the person has septic arthritis, in this case caused by Neisseria gonorrhea, right? And remember, typically the way it's going to present is it's going to affect more than one joint. This is not a monoarthritis like you see in most cases of septic arthritis. It's going to be a polyarthritis. It's going to affect many, many joints, right? And then they will also typically have some kind of rash on the skin, right? The rash can be vesicular, it can be pustules, it can be papules, it can be ecchymoses, right? And then typically they'll also have this phenomenon known as tenosynovitis. In fact, let me give you a trick here. If you see on the USMLE exams a young person and you see the term tenosynovitis, you really want to think about gonococcal arthritis, right? What in the world do I mean by tenosynovitis? Well, tenosynovitis literally means that the synovium that bathes, the synovium that basically showers tendons, you know, it's like inflamed, right? So it hurts, right? That's very classic in people that have gonococcal arthritis, right? So it's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? And typically, you know, you're going to treat this person with something like ceftriaxone, right? You're going to give ceftriaxone. Although, if you've not ruled out chlamydia, you also need to add in some doxycycline or azithromycin, right? And then, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 24-year-old male, right? Or let's say female, 24-year-old female, and that for the past, 24 hours, she has been noticing this purulent cervical discharge, right? And then we're told that, gram stain of the discharge reveals a gram-negative organisms, right? So let's put it that way. Discloses gram-negative organisms, right? Gram-negative cocci. And then they tell you that without treatment, which of the following complications would most likely arise from this person's presentation? Well, if you see this, I'd really hope you're thinking of the answer that talks about pelvic inflammatory disease, right? In fact, our friends at the MBMEs, they like to do this thing with complications of disease or presentations of disease or prognoses of disease these days, right? So this person, what is the original thing the person has? Well, the person has something called a mucopurulent cervicitis, right? Mucopurulent cervicitis. Cervicitis is something that can be caused by chlamydia. It can also be caused by chlamydia trachomatis or gonorrhea, right? Neisseria gonorrhea, right? Now, the thing is, if you treat it, again, the treatment is the same as what you used to treat. So you give like ceftriaxone plus doxycycline or ceftriaxone plus azithromycin. But if you don't treat it, it can actually progress to a pelvic inflammatory disease, right? Pelvic inflammatory disease. And remember, PID, how's that going to present? Well, you're going to see purulent, you know, vaginal discharge, and then you're going to see cervical motion tenderness, and then you're going to see bilateral adnexal tenderness, right? So that's something you're going to see on your exams. Something you just want to keep at the back of your mind. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, has this history, you know, for this second vignette I mentioned, and that the person has been having trouble with fertility, right? This person, you're told that the person has had unprotected intercourse with her husband for you know, like 15 months, and the person has not been able to conceive. And then they ask you about the mechanism behind the patient's symptoms. I'd really hope you're thinking about the answer that talks about fallopian tube scarring. Again, one of these strange things our friends at the MBMEs love to test, right? So what's the deal here? Well, the thing is, people that have had PID, this is why PID is kind of worrisome, right? You don't sleep on PID. You try to actually like treat it because it can become problematic long-term, right? So how can it become problematic? Well, the thing is that infection and inflammation can lead to scarring of the fallopian tubes. And when the fallopian tubes scar, that can increase your risk of things like ectopic pregnancy, right? It can also make things infertile, because if it's scarred, then all those cilia that line the fallopian tubes, they cannot beat the eggs. And if the eggs cannot be beat, then how is he going to find sperm to fertilize it? That's going to be hard, right? That's going to be hard. So keep that at the back of your mind for exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that the patient, you know, 3 weeks ago was placed on an oral hypoglycemic medication, and then the patient presents, you know, was found by his wife, 30 minutes ago that he was passed out, he was unresponsive, and then they tell you that blood glucose measurement, when emergency medical services were called, was like 45, right? And then they ask which of the following is the most likely etiology of this patient's presentation, right? I'd really hope you're picking the answer that talks about sulfonylurea toxicity, right? I'd really hope you're picking the answer that talks about sulfonylurea toxicity, right? The thing is, of all the oral hypoglycemic drugs, the classic one that tends to have the strongest association with hypoglycemia that our friends at the MBMEs love to test are your sulfonylureas, right? So how exactly do sulfonylureas cause this problem? Well, the thing is, if you think about it, if you understand the way insulin is secreted normally, then you're going to understand how sulfonylureas can cause hypoglycemia, right? So remember, insulin comes from the pancreatic beta cells. So if glucose enters through the GLUT2 transporters to the pancreatic beta cells, it then gets phosphorylated to glucose-6-phosphate by glucokinase, right? And then that glucose-6-phosphate is going to be metabolized, obviously, in glycolysis, TCA cycle, and all those things into ATP, right? And then that ATP blocks a potassium channel that we find in the pancreatic beta cell, blocks the potassium channel. When you block that potassium channel, potassium will not be able to leak out of the cell. Because remember, potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So potassium cannot leak out of the cell. If it cannot leak out of the cell is going to depolarize, because you're retaining more of a positive charge within the cell. The cell is going to depolarize. Then that's going to cause, right? That's going to cause a voltage-gated calcium channel to open. Calcium is going to rush into the pancreatic beta cell, and then you're going to shoot out insulin. Okay, so again, ATP produced from the metabolism of glucose is going to block a potassium channel in the pancreatic beta cell. That is going to cause the cell to depolarize. A voltage-gated calcium channel is going to open, and then calcium comes in, and then that causes insulin to be released together with C-peptide, right? That's how insulin is released, right? So how do sulfonylureas work? Well, sulfonylureas, that potassium channel that I said is blocked by ATP, is also blocked by sulfonylureas. In fact, sulfonylureas literally trigger the secretion of insulin. Okay? They literally trigger the secretion of insulin, right? So they block that ATP-dependent potassium channel. Insulin is secreted. And think about it. If you're a thing that causes more insulin to be secreted, well, what do you think is going to happen to your blood glucose levels? That can actually lead to a tanking of your blood glucose, right? So again, that's how sulfonylureas work. And remember, of all the oral hypoglycemic agents, the one that probably has the, is not probably, on the USMLE exams, the one that has the strongest association with hypoglycemia are going to be your sulfonylureas. And then one thing I just want to say here, just to kind of tie in another pathology or another concept is your meglitinides. Your meglitinides are another group of diabetes medications. They include drugs like repaglinide and nateglinide. Those drugs also work just like the sulfonylureas. They actually block that ATP-dependent potassium channel. But there are two key differences between those drugs and the sulfonylureas. They have less risk of hypoglycemia compared to the sulfonylureas. Number two, they are not associated with sulfur allergy. So if a person has a sulfur allergy and you don't want to give them a sulfonylurea, a very good idea in those circumstances is to strongly consider a meglitinide like repaglinide or nateglinide, right? And then one other thing I want to tie in is I said that, hey, if you want to make ATP in a pancreatic beta cell, right, glucose enters through GLUT2 and then is converted to glucose 6-phosphate by a glucokinase, right? And then that glucose 6-phosphate is metabolized, you make ATP and block that potassium channel. Well, the thing is, what if glucokinase does not work? Or what if glucokinase is not as sensitive? What kind of disease will that increase your risk of? So let's say for whatever reason, glucokinase is just not very sensitive to glucose. Because again, literally what does glucokinase do? It converts glucose to glucose 6-phosphate. That conversion needs to happen for ATP to be made in the pancreatic beta cell. But if glucokinase does not respond very well to glucose, if it's not very sensitive to glucose, or let's say there's some kind of genetic mutation in glucokinase, are you going to make glucose 6-phosphate? No. If you don't make glucose 6-phosphate, are you going to make ATP in a pancreatic beta cell? No. If you don't make ATP in a pancreatic beta cell, are you going to close that potassium channel and release insulin? No, you won't. So those people are going to have hypoinsulinemia, and that can lead to them developing diabetes. That is very, very high yield to know for your exams. In fact, our friends at the MBMEs, they like to test MODY, M-O-D-Y, maturity onset diabetes of the young. Maturity onset diabetes of the young. One of the classic pathophysiologies our friends at the USMLEs love to test is they love to test it from the perspective of a glucokinase mutation, right? So you can have a glucokinase mutation where it takes a very high amount of glucose for it to start working, or the glucokinase doesn't just even work at all, right? That can absolutely, positively lead to hypoinsulinemia, which can also lead to diabetes. Again, you may think that, oh, Divine, this is too basic sciencey. There's no way I would ever see it on my exams, until you then see it on your exams and you're like, that's strange, right? So please keep that at the back of your mind on your test. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this is a 42-year-old male and his BMI is 31, and you're told that his hemoglobin A1C is 7.3, right? And you're told that this person has not visited the physician within the last 10 years. And you're told that, you know, his blood pressure is like 149 over 85. And, you know, you're told that his total cholesterol is like 267. And then they ask you, without treatment, which of the following represents the most likely cause of mortality in this patient? Well, if you see that, I really hope you can pick the answer that talks about coronary artery disease. This is super high yield to know for your test. Again, if you notice, I'm talking about the most common cause of mortality. I'm hitting prognosis in this podcast. This person has diabetes, right? The A1C is pretty high. What is the most common cause of death in a diabetic on your exams? The most common cause of death in a diabetic on your exams is going to be coronary artery disease. Guys, this is super, super high yield to know for your test. What is the most common cause of death in a diabetic on the USMLE exams? The most common cause of death in a diabetic on the USMLE exams is going to be coronary artery disease. It's going to be coronary artery disease. Okay, coronary artery disease. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about, they give you an arrow question on your exams, and they want you to use that arrow, they want you to use a series of arrows to differentiate type 1 diabetes from type 2 diabetes. They want you to differentiate literally type 1 diabetes from type 2 diabetes. And they give you, you know, and your arrows include insulin, your arrows include C-peptide, right? And then your, so how do you differentiate type 1 diabetes from type 2 diabetes that way? Well, I'd really hope that you're saying that for type 1 diabetes, the person is going to have decreased insulin and decreased C-peptide. But for type 2 diabetes, the person is going to have increased insulin and increased C-peptide. You're like, wait, what? Hey, I thought in diabetes you have an insulin deficiency. Right. So let's talk about it, right, to make sure it makes sense in your head, right? So what happens in type 1 diabetes? Well, remember, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune insulitis. You literally make autoantibodies against your pancreatic beta cells against insulin, right? So your beta cells basically die. If your beta cells die, you're literally not going to make insulin. If you're not making insulin, you'll also not make C-peptide. So your insulin is going to be low and your C-peptide is going to be low as well. Okay. But contrast this with a person that has type 2 diabetes, right, where they have more of an insulin resistance. So these people are actually making tons and tons of insulin. It's just that the body is very resistant to it. So in type 2 diabetes, your insulin is going to be very, very high, and your C-peptide is going to be very, very high as well. Okay. Remember, type 2 diabetes is not an autoimmune disease. Type 1 diabetes is. Okay, type 1 diabetes is, right? And one evil, let me not call it an evil question, but one strange, bizarre thing our friends at the MBMEs could do to you on the exams. Do you know what they can do to you? They can literally give you a question about a person that's a diabetic, right? And the person is not on any medication. And then they also give you other things like the person smokes and the person has like high blood pressure and all these things. And then they ask, which of the following interventions would cause the greatest decrease in mortality over the next 10 years in this patient? And they will give you an answer that says blood sugar control. They will give you an answer that says blood pressure reduction. They will give you an answer that says smoking cessation. Which answer choice should you pick? I really hope you're picking the answer that says smoking cessation, right? Again, it will be a diabetic that smokes, but stopping smoking is going to help that diabetic a lot more than targeting their blood sugars. You're like, wow. Yes, that is a very high yield thing to know for your exams, right? Because the thing is, smoking causes so many problems. Smoking causes high blood pressure. Smoking causes lung cancer. Smoking causes bladder cancer. Smoking causes renal cell carcinoma. Smoking causes pancreatic cancer. Smoking causes a triple A. Smoking causes PAD. Smoking causes a lot of problems, right? So the thing is, even if you have blood sugars that are out of control and you're a diabetic, if you smoke, smoking cessation is going to reduce your risk, is going to reduce your mortality by more than controlling the person's blood sugar. That is very, very, very high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. That is extremely high yield to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 55-year-old female and you're told that she has a remote history of breast cancer? And that over the last 3 months, she has been having a profound shortness of breath. And you're told that profound shortness of breath, and that on physical exam, you can hear crackles in her lungs. And then you're told that on echocardiographic evaluation, there's biventricular dilation. If you see this, what is the most likely cause of the patient's presentation? Well, I hope you're saying, Divine, this person likely has drug toxicity. They will just put an answer that says drug toxicity. Remember, the breast when a person has breast cancer, right, you can treat it with, chemo, radiation, surgery, and all those things, right? But you're seeing this person has a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So what's going to be the likely cause of the dilated cardiomyopathy? Well, it can be caused by trastuzumab, although trastuzumab is going to cause a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy. But your anthracyclines, right? Your doxorubicin, your donorubicin, right? In the chemo world, they call those red devils. Those can also cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. But in this case, it's going to be an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy. It's going to be an irreversible dose-dependent dilated cardiomyopathy. So what's the mechanism behind the dilated cardiomyopathy, the irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy that we see with doxo and donorubicin? They love to test this a lot on the exams. So actually, that arises from a series of reasons, right? So number one is that we know that these anthracyclines are topoisomerase 2 inhibitors, right? They literally inhibit topoisomerase 2. Well, the thing is, they don't just inhibit topoisomerase 2 in cancer cells. They can also inhibit topoisomerase 2 in many cells of the body, right? So like, for example, they can inhibit topoisomerase 2 in your cardiac myocytes, right? And as they inhibit topoisomerase 2 in your cardiac myocytes, that's going to cause death of those cardiac myocytes, right? Because, you pretty much stop cell division. So that is going to trigger apoptosis, and that's going to cause death of the cardiac myocyte. So that's one mechanism, right? And the thing is, these drugs, they're also very toxic to the mitochondria. How are they toxic to the mitochondria? Well, the thing is, they will accumulate intracellularly, and then they bind iron. And when they bind iron, they cause the generation of lots of reactive oxygen species. And those reactive oxygen species are very toxic to the mitochondria. And when you damage the mitochondria, that's going to cause the release of a lot of pro-apoptotic substances like caspases from the mitochondria. And that can cause programmed cell death of that cardiomyocyte, right? So that's why those people are going to have dilated cardiomyopathy. And one of the ways you can prevent this is, number one, give a smaller dose because it's dose dependent. But number two, another thing that's very high yield to know here is that you can also use the drug dexrazoxane. Dexrazoxane is an ion chelator, right? By binding up the iron that is around, then you won't be able to do the fainting reaction that your anthracyclines like doxorubicin and donorubicin use to cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay, and then the last thing I think I want to address here, and then we'll go ahead and wrap this up. This is a rapid review podcast. Is what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 25-year-old female and she goes for a pap smear. And then they tell you that, oh, that examination of the pap smear by a pathologist reveals, you know, like a densely, reveals abnormal squamous cells with a densely packed nucleus with a surrounding perinuclear halo, right? So they tell you, you see abnormal squamous cells with a densely packed nucleus with a surrounding perinuclear halo. And then they ask you, which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? Well, I really hope you're picking the answer that talks about HPV, right? The thing is, many of you know that, hey, of course, Divine is talking about a pap smear and we're seeing abnormal findings. Of course, it's got to be HPV, right? I can promise you our friends at the MBME exams, they will test this thing in an indirect fashion to throw you off, right? So they may tell you things like, hey, abnormal squamous cells with a densely packed nucleus and surrounding surrounding perinuclear halo, right? What cell type am I describing here? Well, I'm describing a coelocyte. If you look at this thing histologically, I will actually encourage you to be able to identify this histologically. They look like fried eggs. Right? So whenever you see coelocytosis on your exams, think about HPV infection. In fact, think about the HPV 16s and 18s, right? The ones that tend to be associated with cancer. So I would imagine that that person at some point is going to need some kind of colposcopy with biopsy. Now, just to wrap this up, what are the pathologies that have that fried egg appearance that we see on the USMLE exams? Well, we've talked about the HPV coelocytes, right? Don't forget your testicular seminomas, and also don't forget the brain tumor, that brain tumor that likes to grow in the frontal lobe, the oligodendroglioma, It's also associated with that fried egg appearance. All right, so we're going to go ahead and stop here. Again, if you love the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. You're going to love one-on-one tutoring with me. I offer a bunch of review classes for the USMLE exams. I actually have a bunch that start in the month of March, right? So I have a 2.5 hour test taking class. I have a 4 hour biostatistics class. I have a 5 hour social science, ethics, quality improvement, and hospital medicine class. These first three classes are for step one all the way to step three. They're all held over Zoom. All my classes actually are held over Zoom. And then I have a 20 hour step two, step three class. And I have a 3 hour last minute review. That's just exclusively for step two and step three. And then I have a 50 hour class taking place in the month of June, held only once a year, very limited spots available. That is for step two CK and step three. And then I also have a 25 hour step one class. So if you're interested in any of these classes, just shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. I'm the one that teaches all these classes. I teach them through Zoom. I also offer one-on-one tutoring, and I also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and things like that. And remember, I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify, so check those out. And I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower, so every week I post like one or two podcasts where, from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 636. Again, pay attention to these mechanisms. They are very high yield. They are very testable. So have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.